Very well. So we have Simulado Software versus Proton Infotech Private Ltd. Mr. Larza and Mr. Sargent, I just wanted to mention to both of you on behalf of the court, our staff, as you know, evaluates cases when they come in, and they made this case appear to be far, far, far more complicated than it appears to be. With the good job that you did in your briefs, you're entitled to your 20 minutes, but the court strongly encourages both of you to use far less than that amount of time in presenting your case, if you will, please. So, Mr. Sargent, you're first representing Photon. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chris Sargent, and I represent Appellant Photon Infotech Private Limited, and I would like to reserve at least 5 minutes for rebuttal if possible.
We'll try to help you. Keep your eye.
Thank you, Your Honor. My client's here today because we're requesting that the contract between the parties and applicable law be consistently applied between both parties. And the fundamental error we believe that the district court made is that court's order provided benefits to the respondent in the form of contract damages and attorney's fees, while also taking away my client's protections of limited liability under that same contract. In addition to that key inequity, there are two complicating factors making this a little more difficult than the average case, and they both result from choices that the respondent made here. First, respondent chose to seek rescission on its fraud claim far too late, and second, respondent chose to seek at trial the exact same remedy for both its contract and its tort claims. On the first point, respondents chose to try and rescind the contract, leading to the prior reversal by this court. And in that decision, this court held that respondent succeeded on the merits of its contract claim and was entitled to damages under that claim in the amount of approximately $18,000, and reversed the order granting rescission. However, in the order at issue on the first appeal here, the district court did not address this complication at all, especially the part of the decision regarding damages for breach of contract. Instead, the district court elided that and just awarded damages under the tort theory. We submit that that's an error because the prior decision of this court was law of the case. It had to be addressed head on. And the district court was without power to ignore this court's findings on contract damages. And this is a material issue because there can't be a double recovery, as was warned by the in the prior decision.
Let's say that we agree completely. There can't be a double recovery based upon the same allegations. But in this case, it seems like California states that fraud is an example of a tort that's independent of a contractual breach. So why does the economic loss doctrine bar a tort recovery of damages in this case? Admittedly, you can't get both, but why couldn't the court award a tort damages award that would not be capped by the contract?
I think in light of the prior decisions of this court, that if they were separate damages for fraud from the contract damages, those could have been awarded outside of the contract and outside of the economic loss doctrine. The issue
our prior court didn't decide that issue, did it?
Correct. They did not address directly the economic loss issue. And I don't think this court even needs to get to the economic loss issue because of the bar on double recovery here. Specifically, this court did award contract damages of $18,000. That is where the starting point of the analysis should begin, and I believe they should also end because the fraud damages are duplicative. And when you look at things like the economic loss doctrine for the damages that can be awarded in fraud outside of the contract, they are for damages that are outside of the contract based on claims that are outside of the contract.
Well, in this case, if I understand correctly, the fraud and the inducement is what we've been alleged here, and that is a pre-contractual claim. So why should the contractual liability cap apply to such a fraud claim?
Because the remedy awarded on that claim was for damage, the same exact damages as were awarded on the contract, and they were contractual foreseeable damages in the form of out-of-pocket costs and lost profits.
I'm having trouble understanding your logic here. Again, correct me if I'm wrong on the facts. The allegation on the fraud was there was fraud in the inducement of the contract. That's one time period before the contract becomes into effect. And you got the contract. It's clear that damages under the contract are capped. Everybody seems to agree on that, including our previous panel. The question is whether if you have a fraud in the inducement, which is not part of the basically they wasn't part of the contract because that's what led to it in the first place. Why is that not a separate contractual, separate damage calculation?
Because they did not seek separate damages on that basis, on those frauds at trial. The damages that they sought and were awarded by the jury were the same exact damages on the contract as in the fraud claim.
So you're saying that the jury didn't say this is for fraud, this is for contract?
Correct. The plaintiff, the Simulados, at trial asked for two measures of damages in the form of lost profits and out-of-pocket expenses on both its fraud and its contract claims. The jury awarded those same damages to the dollar on both claims in the special verdict form. So there's no distinction. This is why I think the Lazar decision is instructive.
Well, counsel, I get that you can't pay, so let's assume I agree with you on all of that. You can't pay them for both under the bar on double recovery. And you can only pay up to $18,000. It's over $18,000 what the jury awarded, but you can only pay up to $18,000 on the contract. So why then can't the party sort of elect and say, I don't want my $18,000, which is less. I want, it's the same damages. I don't want double recovery, but I want the same damages, but in the tort bucket.
The place to make that election would have been either during or before trial, not
why,
now.
Because I think that's what your argument has to be. But I don't see that the prior panel said that. And I'm not sure that what case law do you have for the fact that you got to make that election up front? I understand you can't get double recovery, but it's not clear to me that you have to decide at the beginning of the lawsuit.
I don't know that there's any case law directly on point, and I've looked for it, that deals with the specific situation that we're dealing with here, where you have the interaction of two claims with the same remedy and a limitation of liability clause. I think that's one of the things I've been struggling with here. And so I think that when you look at these kinds of cases, and this is where the economic loss doctrine may have some impact, where when you look at issues where you're looking at economic issues, contract remedies, the contract issue controls, and that is what the Lazar decision of the California Supreme Court says, that you look first to remedies and contracts, and you can't recover.
That seems to me a slightly different issue, which is the issue of whether or not the loss limitation that the $18,000 applies also to torts. If it applied to torts, I agree. You couldn't get $18,000 for torts and $18,000 for call. That'd be an interesting question, because maybe you get one part of the damages for torts and one, so you're not getting a double recovery, right? You're getting But that's a different question than I think what I was asking earlier, which is your point earlier was if you're getting damages, and they're the same damages for both, right? The same damages for the tort violation and for the contract violation, but you're limited on what you could get for torts. And so why can't you just pick, for a contract, why can't you just pick the tort one, and if there's no case law, why can't you just pick the tort one? I think you're backing into because the $18,000 limit applies to the tort, but that's a separate question, right?
It's certainly a separate question whether or not the limitation of liability applies to the fraud claim. My argument is based on double recovery principles. I think the answer, I would also frame it perhaps a different way in your question, which is, where is the authority that allows them to elect which claim they get to recover on post-trial and post-special verdict? If they didn't
doesn't California law, I know there is a presumption that you're going to look to the contract damages, but fraud is an exception to that, is it not?
Fraud is an exception to the limitations.
To the presumption that you look to the contract.
No, well, the Lazar case is a fraud case, Your Honor, and it says in the context fraud claim that for the damages that overlap between fraud and contract, you look at the contract first.
Perhaps I misunderstand. You can correct me on this, but my understanding is that when you have both a tort and a contract claim, and that the presumption is that you look for contract damages. But I understand the case law from California to say that when fraud's involved, that's not necessarily the case. That's an exception. Is that not correct?
I don't believe that that is correct. With the,
what case would you cite to that effect?
The Lazar decision.
Okay.
I think that because, and that, and the reason why I think that's instructive is because it delineates on fraud damages between the damages that overlap with the contract damages and the damages that are independent on fraud. And it says where they, where the damages overlap in both contract and fraud, you look to the contract first. And where the damages down only in fraud, that is the exception. And those damages can be awarded and in addition to or outside of the contract.
But that doesn't address, that doesn't address, I mean, that's all about, you can't get double recovery. So I understand that. So I said, but once you, I mean, if you had a contract that said you get $1 is what we're limiting contractual damages, you know, some sort of, then that's kind of a different issue. You can look to the contract first, but then once you determine that you can only get a dollar for contract, it doesn't go further and say, then you can't say, instead, I'll take my tort damages. Does it?
The contract, I'm not sure I understand. I don't think the contract says that correct, but the California law.
The California case law doesn't say that you can't. It says you look to the contract first, but I don't think these cases you're talking about are dealing with the situation where your contract damages are reduced beyond, where your recover, what you can recover under contract is reduced because of a clause like this. In other words, the whole point of the case is to prevent double recovery, but you're not going to get double recovery because you're limited in what you can get for recovery on the contract.
I understand. The difficulty is then if they recover under the contract, they're required to recover, I believe they're required to recover under the contract first. So then what happens to, and you're right that there's now, because of the unique facts of this case that I don't think have been addressed by the California courts directly before, where that is subject to a limitation of liability, what happens to that gap?
Yeah, and it's just not clear to me that, a rule against double recovery is very logical. It makes sense, right? I mean, we could, but a rule that like that double recovery bars you from moving on to your tort damages when your contract damages are limited doesn't necessarily follow from the logic of a double recovery. So maybe you would say you get the first $18,000 out of contract and then you have to subtract $18,000 from your tort, something to prevent you from getting double recovery. But it's not clear to me that you're relying on double recovery to say you just don't get tort damages at all. But that's not double recovery in this case because of the limitation on your contract damages.
I actually would suggest that it is because the way that it works is they were awarded the full $309,000 in contract, and then under that contract, that amount was reduced. So their complete remedy on
it's almost like you're saying a rule against double liability, not double recovery. Recovery has the concept of actually getting the money, I think.
I think to some extent that that's true, that they got their recovery from the contract claim, and that part of the issue is these are foreseeable damages here that were awarded under the fraud theory too. The parties are, these are sophisticated commercial parties who knew the contract they're signing. The limitation of liability clause is specifically negotiated.
If it's fraud and inducement, as Judge Smith mentioned, I think it's fraud and inducement. And I it's hard for me to see how that's foreseeable damages, right? Like, I mean, the whole point is I was misled, right? So I was misled. I mean, only in a sense that every contract I enter into, I guess I could guess that somebody may be lying to me about important elements of that contract. But how is that foreseeable?
Because it's the damages that they were awarded here that were foreseeable, not necessarily the fraud itself. The damages they were awarded here were the exact same damages they were awarded in contract. They couldn't have been awarded to them in contract if they weren't contract damages and they weren't foreseeable.
Counsel, let me go back for a moment to the question I asked before. The case that I was looking at was Ehrlich versus Menences, which is a California Supreme Court case that indicated that the presumption is like the contract damages, but if you got a fraud, you can have a separate recovery, if you will. Do you know about that case? If you're familiar with that case?
I am not. I'm Paul. Ehrlich.
Okay. All right. You want to save time? I mean, it's up to you.
Yes. Okay. Yes, please. Thank you.
Very well. All right, Mr. Larza, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Joe Lanza, and
I'm Lanza. I apologize. I said Larza. Apologize.
It's quite all right, Your Honor. I represent Simulata Software, the plaintiff appellee in this case. I think Judge Van Dyke hit the nail on the head when he suggested that you take the $18,000 and award that first, and then you reduce the fraud damages by $18,000 and award the fraud damages. And that's what I actually argued in the brief and before the district court. And there's clear California authority that supports that resolution, as there is.
Counsel, is that what the district court did? Because I thought district court basically just pushed aside the contract and then went.
That is what the district court did. No, I'm sorry. That is not yet. You are correct. The court just pushed aside the contract award and awarded the fraud damages only. My argument in the brief and also to the district court is that it should have done the offset. Okay. And I can argue that on appeal without bringing a cross point. Because as long as I'm not arguing for a judgment that enlarges or a result that enlarges the judgment, I can argue any theory to affirm the underlying judgment, even one not considered by the trial court. And the citation for that that the court may want is Corbello versus Valley, 974 F3rd. 965, that is a Ninth Circuit case, and that relies on a U.S. Supreme Court case, Jennings versus Stevens, 135 Supreme Court, 793. I think the proper result is to offset the fraud damages against the, offset the contract damages against the fraud damages. The California Supreme Court has done the same thing in workers' compensation cases, where you have a worker who has received workers' compensation benefits, sues a third-party tortfeasor, and the third-party tortfeasor tries to get out of the damages by saying that the worker's already been compensated. And the California Supreme Court has said, yeah, you've got double recovery on one hand, but on the other hand, you've got the potential for a wrongdoer to profit from his own wrongdoing. And of those two evils, the latter one is the worst evil. Double recovery is the lesser of two evils. So what we're going to do is we're going to offset the damages.
Can I switch you to a different aspect of this case? I think
Yes. We've
had a good discussion about the double recovery issue, but I want to talk to you about attorney fees, something near and dear to every lawyer's heart. In this case, let's just assume, arguendo, that we conclude that the fraud claim is pre-contractual harm, that the liability cap doesn't apply. How can we then say, for purposes of attorney fees, that the fraud claim amounted to Simulato's enforcing its rights under the contract?
Well, I think that this particular clause is broad enough to support the idea of awards for pre-contract claims. Clauses that are written this broadly are generally enforced, apply to any type of claim arising out of or related to the contract. I also don't believe that it's necessarily a pre-contract claim. All the terms in the contract, all the rights, all the obligations, all the words come directly out of the negotiations. And if the other side is not playing fairly, how can you say that you're not vindicating your rights under the contract when you sue for fraud in the inducement? But that aside, I believe that this particular this particular attorney's fees clause is broad enough to support an award of attorney's fees on the fraud in the inducement claim, even if it is a pre-contract claim.
And would we in this case need to send, it's all arguendo, so Mr. Sargent doesn't worry here, but arguendo, if we decided, as I mentioned, would, in your judgment, would we need to send the issue back to the district court to determine whether these issues are intertwined sufficiently that you need a recalculation of the attorney fees? What would we do?
I believe it's a question of law, and I believe the court can make the determination, the Court of Appeals can make the determination on the appellate fees. All the fees, we did a lodestar analysis, and where we discussed which were entwined or not entwined, I believe. And so I believe this court can look at the lodestar analysis and make that determination itself rather than remand the whole thing back for another determination of attorney's fees by the by the district court.
So, counsel, can I want to ask you this question, but also would like to hear from your opposing counsel what he thinks too. So he should be listening because I'd like to hear on rebuttal. So on paragraph 9, it says, I'm sure you're both intimately familiar with this paragraph, enforce its rights under this agreement, whether in contract, tort, or both. It's pretty obvious, I think, what a right under this agreement in contract would be. So I'm going to kind of mark that out for purposes of this question. So what do you think it means, enforce its rights under this contract in tort? What does that mean?
I think that if there is a tort related to the performance of the contract or the formation of the contract, you can enforce that right. The California Supreme Court in Robinson Helicopter, which is the big economic loss rule case in California, discussed contract negotiations and how that plays in there. And the court said that parties should not be expected to anticipate fraud and dishonesty in the process of negotiating the terms of contracts.
There's a little bit of an irony there because
nobody does.
There's a little irony because you, I think you're saying that, except we did in paragraph 9, you know, because we included this provision that we should be able to get attorney's fees if for a tort, and presumably I assume you would say, and that tort includes fraud and inducement. So, I mean, in your argument that you did sort of anticipate, the parties did anticipate it in paragraph 9 that there might be a tort related to.
I think there may be some irony here. I think there's irony in trying to enforce the limitations of liability clause when you fraudulently induced a contract to begin with. Simulatus doesn't get the benefit of its bargain, but Photon does. I don't see where that's fair. You know, we've talked about four different legal theories in this case that are implicated. The bargain's double recovery, economic loss rule to some extent, the bar against profiting from one's own fraud, which is codified in 1668 of the California Civil Code, and to some extent, predictability in a contract. None of those rules is served by the argument Photon puts forward. It's a roadmap to committing fraud in the inducement in California. Put a liability limitation clause in your contract that says my damages are limited to $5,000, and you're free to commit fraud in the inducement in California, because that clause will bar any recovery in excess of $5,000. Again, I think the solution is offset the contract damages against the fraud damages and award one judgment in the amount of $309,000. That's what the jury found. And that solves the attorney's fees problem as well.
When you say to offset the fee, the jury awarded the $300,000 plus fee for, arguably, for tort as well. Why would that be offset? Why would the contract cap be offset against that?
Well, I think that's a solution that, as I said, has been promoted by the California Supreme Court, but also I would note that this court reached a similar conclusion in the Ambassador case, which is cited in the brief. That's Ambassador Hotel versus Wei Chun Investments, 189 F3rd 1017. In that case, an ambassador paid $8.5 million for stock in a company called Copen. They were involved in a construction project. Later, they sued Copen for fraud and breach of contract, I believe, claiming the stock was worthless. Copen, at the same time, sued other parties in that particular project. The jury awarded Ambassador $8.5 million, and the court calculated the difference between the 8.5 and what it felt the stock was worth, which was zero, to come up with an $8.5 million judgment. The problem was Copen cut a judgment for $11.4 million against the other defendants. So the stock actually did have value, and this court said, look, that is essentially a double recovery. So
I guess I'm puzzled as to how the contractual cap ought to play in this, based upon the facts as I understand them. Allegedly fraud in the inducement, separate from the contract. If we determine that that allows your client to recover the amount that the jury awarded, why do we even get involved with the cap for the contract? Because that's capped at 18,000 and some change, but they get zero. The court awarded them zero. So why should that be a factor?
Well, yes, the court just decided to award fraud damages and fraud damages only.
Right, but the effect was it awarded zero damages for contract because of the double recovery issue, right?
Yes. I think the more appropriate remedy was to offset. But I think the district court's solution was just as valid because you end up with one recovery that makes the plaintiff whole. The purpose of the double recovery rule is to prevent a plaintiff from being overcompensated. It's an unjust enrichment principle. And if you award only $18,000 and nothing more, well, then the plaintiff is undercompensated. So the solution is award him $309,000 in fraud, and that makes him whole. And that's what the district court decided to do.
So that would be a straight affirmance, right?
That would be a straight up affirmance, yes, Your Honor. Mindful of the court's desire to limit our time, unless you all have any more questions.
Do either of my colleagues have additional questions? I think not. So thank you very much. Mr. Sargent,
thank you.
You have some time. You don't have to use it all, but you're welcome to use some of it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start by trying to respond to Judge Van Dyke's question that he addressed to both of us in terms of, you know, the language about enforcing rights, whether in contract or in tort. I think that the tort that it could be referring to would be things like interference with contractual relations would be, to me, the most obvious one. They could also apply to torts like negligence that may.
So is your position then that it would be a tort that happened if it's enforcing its rights under this agreement in tort? Is your position that it has to be a tort that happens sort of after the contract's formed? Is that related to the contract because after it's formed, not a pre-contractual tort?
Correct. The right for example, a right for performance under the contract. Somehow is alleged to be tortious conduct. So, Photon, my client.
There's a little irony or tension in your argument too, right? Because you're saying that's how this should be interpreted, but you're saying that the attorney's fees limitation, which is in the contract, should also reach back and apply to an attorney's fee award for a pre-contractual tort claim.
My fundamental issue with the district court's order, why I think some form of reversal is needed, is the inconsistency where they were awarded tort damages and then awarded a remedy in contract for attorney's fees. One or the other of those should control here.
I think California law, but I thought about that, but I thought California law allows that. You can contract for attorney's fees for torts. Right?
If the language of the attorney's fees clause is sufficiently broad, which is why your question, I think, is an important one for what is the express language of this particular attorney's fee provision. And, you know, we did that chart in our reply research, the varying clauses and how they do under California decisions. And when you talk about enforcing rights, those are limited and don't apply to torts outside of the contract versus the broader anything relating to the contract.
Okay, so I hear your argument. So my thought would be one way you could sort of try to make everything rectify everything and say, if you were to read that language, enforce its rights under this agreement in tort as, you know, I understand that's not your position, but if you were read that as reaching a pre-contractual tort like fraud and the inducement, then it would stand, it wouldn't necessarily be inconsistent with that to say, well, the parties were addressing that in paragraph 9. And when they were saying you should get attorney's fees, they were also saying you should get attorney's fees for those kind of things that they agreed that, for those kind of things, right? So your argument turns on that enforce its rights under this agreement in tort does not reach both your attorney's fees argument, everything kind of turns on that reading.
With respect to the attorney's fee clause, correct. And I think the more fundamental issue is that if this attorney's fees clause is broad enough to encompass pre-contract tort claims, why isn't the limitation of liability clause as well? Why are the clauses of this contract being selectively applied to the remedies?
Counsel had a pretty good point that That's pretty, I don't know what California said about this, but that's a pretty powerful point that if you allow parties to limit tort damages, then you kind of are creating a roadmap for fraud and inducement to say, you know, I'm gonna commit fraud and inducement, and then when I actually induce them to enter into this contract, I'm gonna limit their damages for that to $1,000.
California has a remedy for that, Your Honor. It's called rescission. They could have sought rescission of the contract that would have wiped out all of these terms. They, in fact, attempted to do that in this case. They just did it far too late. That's the remedy.
Is that all that California provides for that? It doesn't allow you to sort of, if you tried to do this nefarious thing that I'm talking about, wouldn't a California court say, we're not going to limit the damages like that. We're just going to knock out that damages.
California law allows for an election in a fraud and inducement case to either rescind the contract or elect to affirm the contract and sue for fraud. And it's the latter situation that we're dealing with here.
In the prior panel said, too late to rescind.
Correct.
Very well, additional comments, Mr. Sargent?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Whether my colleagues have additional questions?
Very helpful. Thank you.
So we thank both counsel for your very helpful argument. And thank you both for your being mindful of the court's admonition at the beginning. You've done a wonderful job in trying to be respectful of that. So we thank you both. The case just argued, Simulado Software versus Botan Infotech Private LTD is hereby submitted. And the court stands in recess until tomorrow at 9:00. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This court for this session stands adjourned.